Welcome back to Behind the Play. My name is Alex Adams, and today I'm joined by Solomon Volagy of TSN, who covers the Calgary Flames. Thanks so much for coming on for the second time. We really appreciate it on this show. How's everything going in Calgary? It's been a quite up and down season to begin with. What's that been like for you, just to kind of with the season, kind of just getting off the ground?
Yeah, Alex, it's been fun. There's way less kind of tension around the team given there's not those free agents. So we don't have to ask players every day about their futures over here, and there's not, players complaining through the media about their situation. So that's been a good departure. Like, it really is just Dan Vladar and Andrei Kuzmenko that are pending free agents. The vibe around the team is a lot different. I think that they're embracing the lack of expectation. It seems a lot lighter of an atmosphere around the rink, and I think they know that they're going to be in tough to make the playoffs, but they've also overachieved a little bit early on here, and I think they played well even though they've lost 5 of 6. But no, I think it's a different type of year in the sense that Flames fans really don't have a ton of hope that this group is gonna go on a run. If that happens, then it's sort of a happy accident type of thing. But in the past, they've had teams that have spent to the cap that have been really talented on paper that underachieved. And whereas now, I think they're among the bottom spending teams in the league on their roster so far, and they've still got good players. But I think everyone knows that this isn't necessarily about this season. It's about future seasons. So they're basking in that, and they're saying the right things, and today in Montreal they have a chance to go maybe do something against the Habs team that struggled a bit. But overall, I'd say that the mood is lighter, it's more fun, it's more jovial. I think sometimes we underestimate how important locker room chemistry is in an organization and in a team. And at times, I don't think they had that last season because a third of their roster had a foot out the door, right? So I think it's all of those factors, and here they are. They're one game over 500 and potentially looking to surprise people further with their good play.
I'm kind of curious from your vantage point, because as an observer from afar, it feels like the Flames, ever since I was have been watching them outside of a year or two as an outlier, they've really been in that mushy middle, right? And they've never really had, there's the R word. I know that in Calgary has talked about the rebuild or retool, I guess, depending on your vantage point. What do you think kind of happens in Calgary if this team does kind of regress to the middle, or do you think their record, which is, essentially a 500 team, is what this team is early on?
I think they're a little bit better than just a 500 team. I still don't think they're going to make the playoffs, but I think they played pretty well at 5-on-5. They held their own versus Winnipeg when Winnipeg was undefeated. And it was a little bit of a borderline call on Nazem Kadri that led to the game-winning goal late in the third period there. Even versus Edmonton, Martin Paas whistled, another kind of self-inflicted wound where he takes an offensive zone penalty. I think that they're better than people realize. And I know that the expected goals and whatnot is near the bottom or at the bottom of the league, but they held Jack Hughes in check. They've done a good job versus other teams' stars, and they're getting the goaltending right, and I think that's big. And that was a big question mark here. Would Dustin Wolf be figured out by other NHL teams? Would Dan Vladar be able to handle a heavier workload given he just came back from surgery? And they've proven that, right? So there are questions about this group. I think they have to figure out a long-term partner for Ottawa native Mackenzie Weegar. Like, Miramanov, that was a really good bet to make at 1.25 mil, but he has not shown yet to be that guy. And I wonder if Craig Conroy, they need a right shot center. Like, their face-off percentage has been really bad, and you can tell in certain critical situations in a game, you just want someone that can win a draw on that right side. But beyond that, they can move the puck. Rasmus Anderson's had a really good season. I think, like, Connor Zary hasn't necessarily scored a ton, but he's taking that next step. And they have a lot of pieces. It's just like any team that wants to eventually be a perennial Stanley Cup team, you need a true number one center. And They don't really have that right now, and I think center depth in the entire organization is lacking. But I think that they're a better team than people realize. I think they'll probably finish 5 games above 500 would be my guess, and that would be, to me, a really good season. And the questions now are not only about Kuzmenko and Vladar, but you talk about Rasmus Anderson and him being eligible to sign an extension next summer. What might that figure look like? And you have to consider that they've got Hunter Vucevic and Zane Parayi in the system. And do they have room for both the kids and the vets? So they've got some interesting questions. They've cited Dallas a few times as a model that they want to follow. And in order to do that, you have to hit on picks that are outside the top 10. And it looks like they have. I know Parayi was ninth, but even Vucevic being acquired in the Lindholm deal. So some interesting questions about the short and long term, but I think there'll be a five games above 500 would be a prediction of mine come April.
I guess with that maybe bigger picture, is that the right approach for this team and for Craig Conroy to be a 500 team and not get a high pick in this 2025 draft? And is there enough in, as you mentioned, in the cupboard with maybe a lack of center depth to take that next step maybe next year, the year before, or do they really need to go back? Like, do you think the approach by Conroy is the right one?
I think it's an interesting one. Like I don't necessarily like it's been talked about a lot going into a full rebuild like Anaheim and San Jose have right now and what Edmonton tried to do for a long time there. It's risky, right? Number one, you're allowing potentially a culture of losing to set in. You're not necessarily creating a winning environment. How do veterans feel about the idea that, hey, this season, forget the playoffs, forget anything. We want that number one pick. I'm sure they understand sort of the science behind it, but that's a really tough sell to your players. Secondly, fans can talk all they want about a rebuild, but will you still buy tickets? Will the brand take a hit? It seems like there are a lot fewer rebuild success stories than there have been. Than there are more failures, right? Even in Ottawa, there have been stops and starts there. Buffalo. There are lots of organizations that have tried this and not really done it all that well. To me, like I was having this debate with a buddy the other day, like you can acquire, once you have enough draft capital prospects, you can maybe make a move and acquire that center, not by tanking. Like I think the Flames have for a while really wanted to make an Alex Newhook type trade, like a young center for a couple of high draft picks. Like kind of like, you know, they like it's all about those bets on players that change of scenery, bigger role, different system, they might flourish. And they've made a couple of good ones over here with like Yegor Sharangovich is the big one. And I think that if they could acquire a center who's a right shot and in that 23, 25 age range and someone that has untapped potential, offensively particularly, they would do that. So I agree with Conroy that what happens if that losing culture seeps in and you're not really able to get rid of it, right? Like Buffalo's been trying that for a decade. Ottawa's sort of figuring out how do they take the next steps, Alex, and you've seen that firsthand. And Edmonton tried for years and they got Connor, and that was ultimately what propelled them out of it. But I agree with Conroy in the sense that you like it's such a risky road that the odds are stacked against you even with the lottery. And I'm curious what they do with these picks and these prospects now because you have kids that are budding and there's not going to be spots for all of them. And you probably know that Uyghur, Huberto, and Kadri will be around the team, you know, once Parekh makes it, for instance. And like you're not giving 12 spots to 12 prospects, right? So it'll be fascinating. I think that this regime in Calgary is more creative than the previous one, and they're going to do some things that make fans maybe turn their head a little bit. But whether it's weaponizing cap space or making that Alex Newhook type trade, and I think it's a really interesting situation for them to be in. And look at the draft capital and prospects they have. They might be a really fascinating team to watch at this trade deadline, but for very different reasons to last trade deadline.
I'm curious. You mentioned Huberto and obviously Kadri. Like, those were the two guys that came in the summer of, when Tkachuk got traded. I'm curious for you, because of just how big Huberto's contract is. It seems like this year, from afar that he's been contributing much better than maybe in previous years in Calgary. How much do you believe that's maybe sustainable? And maybe he might not be the guy who's had over 100 points in Florida, but that he's maybe turning a bit of a corner in Calgary.
Yeah, I think it's been incremental, and I really like Jonathan as a human being. Like, I'm willing to say that, and like I think he's a really genuine guy. He, I think, at times has bore the burden of that contract really personally, and it's been a hard time for him. I think it's been a slow kind of work in progress for him, even with Ryan Huska, the head coach, flew up to Quebec to see him over the summer. And I think at times it's been tricky to figure out who Jonathan Huberdeau is in Calgary, right? We know that he is not likely to ever repeat a triple digit point season in these colors. But at, a lot of the time, if you look at his line, it's third in even strength ice time. So is he a third liner right now? Well, maybe not in the traditional sense because he's not really a shutdown type forward, Alex. He gets a lot of offensive zone starts. I think fundamentally, we don't realize maybe that there's a huge difference between the Eastern Conference and the Western Conference in style of play. And at times I've wondered if the Flames should adapt to their X's and O's a little bit more to Huberdeau, who I think likes to create between the dots and in the neutral zone more than he necessarily is right now. I think that's maybe a little bit where his wheelhouse is. But if you look at it, it's a lot of dump and chase. It's a lot of finish the F1 finishes their check, feeds out into the slot, and gets a shot. And if you look at how Huberdeau created offense in Florida, from what I saw, he was almost never behind the opposition net. He was always in transition. He's always in the neutral zone, and that's how he found whether it was Sam Bennett or Carter Verhaeghe or Barkov. Like, that's how he created. And I think, and I'm not a hockey coach or anything, but I think at times the Flames rely on dump and chase a little bit too much instead of carrying the puck in and getting creative in the neutral zone. And I think there's a really good argument to be made, and I've had it here in Calgary with friends, that you do have to, and I know hockey's different, sorry for ranting here, but like I know hockey's different than other sports because even the McDavids of the world, maybe at their absolute peak, will play half the game and that's it. Whereas in basketball, it's a lot higher up a number and it's a lot smaller for roster. But I think you do have to make the argument that tailor your systems a little bit to Jonathan Huberdeau's skill set. And if that results in, say, 5 to 10 more even strength goals in a season, that the margins in this league are pretty small. And that could be the difference between a ninth place and an eighth place. So he is killing penalties. He's getting more defensive responsibility. But I think that there's sort of a mushy middle that Huberdeau, he's had some struggles, and I think he's had some challenges with the coaching here the past few years. But at the same time, the organization, if you tweak your systems to suit the highest paid player in franchise history, I think that's a risk worth taking, and I'm not necessarily sure they've quite done that yet.
That's interesting. I think just the play style, because watching the Senators and the Eastern Conference, and my dad's a Jets fan, so I watch a lot of Central Division hockey, and it is a quite different style, much more brooding, much more dump and chase. And the Eastern Conference, it always feels like it's a bit of a run and gun. Like, it depends on who you're playing against, unless it's the Islanders or something like that. But and that's what, when you think about Jonathan Huberdeau, you think about him creating with the puck on his stick, right? Facilitating, and that doesn't really occur when you're dumping and chasing, right? And that wasn't his strength. So that's a really interesting point.
Yeah, and I think it's on the player too to adapt, but ultimately, like the Habs tonight, like that's a team that has defensive deficiencies this season, we can say. Like, they haven't had great goaltending. They have questions on their back end. So if you're the Flames and you've had some struggles scoring, I think sometimes adapting to your opponent is a route to take. And I think I saw he was playing with Mantha and Sharon Govich today. So I think there's more to give with Jonathan, but if you're kind of like, they dump it in more this season than last season. And I think if you're kind of stymieing the offensive talent that Huberdeau has, then I'm not sure I'm not sure that he will even get to 60 points, right? And that's going to be a question around this organization for a long time, is how do you maximize this player that you signed to a pretty long contract before he'd even played a regular season game? And it's one that arguably turned the fate of the organization on its head, right? So it'll be interesting to see how it plays out. But I think Jonathan's kind of owned it a lot, at least with media, whereas I've seen other players in the league with high profile contracts that haven't performed well that have not owned it publicly. And so it's probably Jonathan, like, even I've like seen him out in Calgary, like out on the town or whatever, and like he hasn't, like, he's really genuine with the fans, and he's a good guy. I think he's taken that weight of that deal quite personally at times, and I mean, who wouldn't, right? So
I'm curious, do you talk to him in French often for, as a Montrealer? Then obviously.
a little bit just with him and Peltier, just to joke around a little bit, but like when it comes to actual conversation, it's mostly English. But just like we say a little bit of slang to each other at times, but that's pretty much it. So a little bit of a way to practice my French. And yeah, like they're really good guys, both of them, but no, mostly English, except for I'll say the occasional Quebecois phrase to them, and they'll get a laugh out of it with my kind of Albertan accent, but that's pretty much it. So
Did you say anything ahead of them going to Montreal or anything like that?
no, I didn't run into him or anything. They were practicing at Windsport, which is like the Canadian Olympic Park over here, which is a little bit trickier to get one-on-one time with players because it's not their locker room, and it's a little bit more controlled by the team. But I'm sure he'll have a good game. Like, he's probably got lots of family there, and I'm sure that he's whenever you see a huge media horde like that, I'm sure he's kind of relieved that in Calgary there's like six of us, and in Montreal there's like 60. So he probably misses us a little bit here in Calgary. So
I love it. You kind of talked about just the approach and the dump and chase, maybe more that with this team compared to last year. How would you maybe evaluate Ryan Huska's coaching tenure so far in Calgary?
good question. I think he's done a good job. I think he's not being brought in to win them the Stanley Cup, right? Like, the framing of expectations, I think, is really crucial here, Alex. Like, he was brought in to be a teacher, I think, first and foremost, and I think he's done a decent job of that. Like even Jonathan Huberdeau being on the penalty kill more, and Martin Pofs is still getting cameos as Huberdeau's center, and he's on the fourth line right now. But I think his job is to really nurture the development of Zary and Pospisil and even Marimanov to an extent. And he's done a decent job with that, right? Like, I think putting Zary with Backlund and Coleman to start the season was a really smart move, because Backlund and Coleman get all the tough matchups, and it forces Zary to learn how to be a really responsible two-way player, because he's starting like a third of his shifts in the defensive zone, and they're often against Andrei Svechnikov or Leon Draisaitl or whomever. So I think that'll be really, really good for his development. One of the Sportsnet guys made a good point the other day, like Pat Steinberg. He said, like, it never feels like anyone is in Ryan Huska's doghouse. Like, it doesn't, right? Whereas with Daryl, it was really different, where like the media were at the very, very bottom of the doghouse. Like, we were deep, deep, deep in the doghouse. And then it was Huberdeau, and then Peltier was in, so but like with Huska, it, like, even Pospisil after that penalty on Ekholm the other night, missed a couple of shifts, but he was back out there. And I think like Huska's walking that balance of, like, you don't want a young player to sort of get the yips and be too scared to make a mistake, but you also want to hold them accountable, right? And even benching Jonathan Huberdeau last season,
I
was
was
it
gonna,
like, that's an example of that. And like, I don't know, like, I haven't talked to enough players to understand this phenomenon, but like, Huska never really played pro hockey, right? He was with the Kelowna Rockets, and then I think he was gonna like do finance, like he was gonna work in finance. He took a part-time job with the team, and he worked his way up. It's really actually an incredible story. Like Ryan Huska's path to this job is really, really interesting. And it should serve as inspiration for other like aspiring NHL people or whomever. But I imagine that when your coach did not play in the NHL, he's not a Craig Berube, he's not someone that has that experience of playing in the NHL, it's got to be a different feeling get being on the receiving end of those messages or those that accountability. But I think Husk has done a good job, and he tweaked some things. He's empowered his defensemen more in the offensive zone, and that's led to offense. Ultimately, he's got the roster he has. That's a little bit, rebuild, retool. But I think he's done a decent job, and he was brought in not to win them the Stanley Cup, right? He was brought in to be a teacher, and I think he's done that, and he's also tweaked his systems. And I think he's if they finish 5 games above 500, like I think that really will be a testament to his work.
I'm kind of curious because it feels as though some of the young players have vaulted up, but also some of the other young players like Matthew Coronato, that situation's sticky. Like, how would you assess how he's managed the young players that is kind of part of this retool for the Flames?
I think really well. That's where I feel like Coronado, I think he'll be a decent NHLer. But is he like did he outplay Anthony Mantha to earn a top six job? He didn't. And even if it was a marginal difference, well, Mantha's got the size. I think Mantha's a right shot, and those are a little bit more valuable. Mantha's a veteran on an expiring deal, and we can see him potentially being on the Sportsnet or the TSN trade bait list soonish if he has a good season. And if he has a good season, maybe you decide that you want him and Huberto locked up, like playing together for a while beyond this season. So with Coronado, I think that was the good call. Like they're trying to create a situation where young players aren't given spots out of training camp or just because there aren't a ton of vets, right? Like you look at Kevin Rooney being on this team, and they could have waived Kevin Rooney, but he got injured. He had a good camp, and I know his underlying numbers aren't great, but he's a valuable contributor to this team. Like Justin Kirkland being the call up over Jacob Pelletier, that's another sign that Kirkland's late 20s, but you know what? Even though we've got Pelletier and others in the farm system, he fits that role more, and he's played better, so he's going to earn that opportunity. So I think he's done a good job with that. And even with Postecoglou, like he's trying to, like Postecoglou is a really good player in sort of a bottom six role, I think, more than anything. But he's trying to teach Postecoglou how to be aggressive without taking offensive zone penalties, but he doesn't want Postecoglou to be scared. So like, sorry, but like Alex, it would have been really easy to scratch Martin Postecoglou tonight. It would have, right? Like extremely easy. I think that one if Kirkland or Rooney is sitting instead, I think Rooney's going to be the scratch. But Pospisil took a very bad penalty in a game that they could have won. And if there was a lot of other head coaches, then he would have been scratched. But instead, he's on the fourth line, I think, with Lomberg and Kirkland. And like that goes to show that Huska. It's easier to work your way up from the Ryan Huska doghouse than it would be the Darryl Sutter doghouse. And I think that is really key in a period where you're trying to teach young players how to be a pro, everything off the ice and on the ice, and you just don't want them being scared to make mistakes.
What's interesting just from my time in Ottawa was with DJ Smith that there was never really accountability. Like, he let the young players play and feel good about themselves, but if they made a mistake, there wasn't a lot of kind of reinforcing. Okay, no, we don't want you to make those defensive mistakes, right? And it sounds like, at least from afar with Huska, from what you're describing, is that there's a bit of tough love, but it's not just completely negative all the time, like maybe with Darryl Sutter, and not just completely punishing players, but saying, hey, you're gonna miss a couple shifts, but you're gonna still get another chance, right? And I feel like that's the right way to go about it with young players, is to still have some sort of discipline, but not maybe going overboard.
Yeah, and one story I want to do at some point this season is like the generational kind of differences, right? I think Nazem Kadri did some pretty funny things in hindsight as a young player in Toronto. Like he's told a story a lot about like he parked in front of a fire hydrant, and I'm not sure if the car got towed or something, but Brian Burke had a pretty strong conversation with him after, and I wonder how different it is now. Like I'm 32, so I'm closer to the Kadri side of things than like the Connor Zary side of things for age. But Like, how different is it for us in our jobs, Alex, as media people, and how our bosses communicate with us compared to if we'd had these gigs 10 years ago? Like, it's really interesting to me how like Huska after the game versus Edmonton, he was irate at Pastis, although he bit his tongue and he kind of said what you need to say in like 15 words. Whereas like a few years ago, that would have been a completely different conversation. And like the era we're in is really interesting. And like, I wonder, like Calgary's been known to be a little bit of the tough love guy in the Flames locker room. And I wonder how that all works when you've got potentially like a 15, 16 year age gap between some of these players, like how messages are received and like for the Calgary Flames to be successful and get out of this and be a contender quickly, like Connor Zary is probably going to have to be one of their top three most important players, right? And coaching Connor at age 21, 22, whatever he is, and like developing him and making sure that him and these young players are not are getting the message, but are not, constantly playing pissed off at their head coach or pissed off at the veteran that told them something. Like, I find that stuff so fascinating. And like, it's going to be critical that the Flames figure out that happy medium here, as they've got a young roster, but they've got veterans that have won Stanley Cups. And how do those veterans get their messages through to young players that maybe aren't used to hearing those words in that tone, or haven't necessarily like it's a different world now, right? So.
Yeah, no, and I'm not trying to make this about the Sens, but it's more just to talk about my experience with players. But I remember asking a young player on the Senators who's still on the team, but I'm just not going to kind of just keep it anonymous. But with DJ Smith getting fired and then Maltais, and I asked them just like, "What would you thrive under a hard coach?" He's like, "Yeah, I'd be fine." And I was a bit surprised because he it didn't feel I just didn't think that would be his answer, right? I thought it'd be like, "Well, it depends." And I do think it depends on the way you say it and the way you talk about it. I think these players want to be coached. We've talked to Thomas Chabot last year, and he's like, we want to be worked hard. We want to learn. We want to be pushed, right? I feel like if the coach comes from a place of trying to improve the team and a player's game with tough love, without just sinking them to the floor with negativity, then players are for the most part willing, even the younger ones, and willing to open and open to taking it, rather than maybe the old school where they just say, well, scream at you and say you're not playing tonight. And that's not really a message, right? That's just yelling and screaming for no reason, right? If you say, hey, don't do that, that's gonna have consequences and this is what it is, and then they know what to do and what not to do.
Yeah, definitely. And like, I was gonna do something on the Flames. I didn't get around to writing it, but on like screen time and how they really kind of impress upon their players not to look at their phones constantly. And yeah, it's like it's different trying to figure that out. And like I said, they've got a young roster, and it's like maximizing that, because these players don't really know what it is like to be a pro, or things like taking care of your body and nutrition and stuff like that. So lots of lessons being learned here, but it seems like the Flames veterans are even publicly, privately saying the right things and doing all that. So I'm sure that they'll figure it out. So
Maybe going kind of bigger picture with this young core moving forward, how would you maybe assess, we talked about Huska's job, but Craig Conroy's job through, 2 or 3 years on the job now?
Again, I think he's done a really good job. If you look at even the Elias Lindholm trade, and getting Hunter Brusevich and like a D prospect here in Joni Eremo, and draft picks for him. The Yegor Sharangovich find was big. Toffoli was not going to re-sign here, and the fact they got a guy that would score them 30 goals, and they locked up for an extension. That was critical. I think the late Chris Snow had a huge say in that deal, given Yegor wasn't really known, but was an analytical darling. And I think just the overall vibe around the organization. I think Craig Conroy is responsible for a lot of that. Like, they have this behind the scenes series that I don't think the previous regime would have ever come close to green lighting. And it's been really well done, and fans can see glimpses of players in the locker room, and things of that nature. And I think Preg's a big part of that, right? Like, you want to communicate with your fans. I think they understand that during this period, their brand could take a hit, so they have to be proactive with how they communicate, and they have to be open and transparent as much as they can be. What else? So, like the Parayk pick was good. He got assets for, I think, every one of the free agents except for Shillington, who for last trade deadline. Like, the Markstrom deal was tricky because Markstrom really only wanted to go to one or two spots, and Kevin Ball looks like a really, really good find. So they've done a good job. I think the organization is set up where they can take some interesting swings on players that from other teams, and they can use some of that draft capital. And I think he's done a good job too of really impressing that this isn't going to be a lose on purpose type of situation, and this isn't going to be a situation where the young players are not going to be held accountable. And I think that's sort of a top down thing. And they've made some hires in analytics. Like, they've done a good job, I think, of rounding out the organization. And he I think, like if they flip Kuzmenko, then that might be seven pieces you get for Lindholm, and that's a lot, right? So I think overall it's been good. I was a little bit surprised if they didn't get more for Tanev, but who knows what the market is. But I'd say he's done a really good job.
I guess moving forward, like you talked about the expectations for this team, like is it just as we've talked about in Ottawa for many years, playing competitive games at the end of the season? Should it be playoffs? What should the expectations be for this team?
I think you have to look at the young players and their development first and foremost before you can look at wins this season. And will Miramanov become an everyday NHLer? Like, that's if the answer is yes, then that's a check mark, right? Can Connor Zary become a reliable top six two-way forward? If he can be by this season and avoids the sophomore slump, then yes. Dustin Wolf, will he assert himself as the number one goalie? Things like that. I think that's got to be the frame of reference before wins and playoff spots or anything like that. Alex, I just like there's so many questions about those young players. I think that would be the key. And then in terms of wins and whatnot, like, they played at a pretty good pace to start the season, and I think they're capable of repeating that. But I mean, even if they miss the playoffs, but you get really good seasons out of those young players, then that's got to be considered a successful campaign because you know what those players are. And if you're at the point where I think Zary can sign an extension as of right now, actually. So you're kind of getting to the point where you're figuring out who's going to be here for long term, who, like Jacob Peltier, unfortunately, will get kind of lost in the shuffle. And this season to me is all about finding out who those players are, and then from management standpoint, like what they're willing to pay them, or you see a 7-year deal versus three, that type of thing. So
Makes sense. Awesome. Well, Solomon, I really appreciate this. Anything you want to plug for TSN before I let you go?
no, that's all. It's perfect.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much, Solomon. Let's do this again. Maybe when the Flames are maybe in a playoff hunt or even make the playoffs. I for your sake, I hope they play the Oilers or something in the first round or
Yeah, that'd be pretty
Vancouver.
great. That was my second season, so it would be cool to see that again. So
Well, thanks so much for taking the time and doing this, and I'll be sure to be watching all your stuff at TSN, and thanks again.
all right, keep up the good work, buddy. See ya.